Almost everywhere you look these days, capitalism is coming under attack. Protesters from Wall Street to Main Street have raised questions about why so few appear to be reaping so much from the American economy. Even some Republicans, traditional best friends of business, have taken aim at presidential GOP frontrunner Mitt Romney and his work at a private equity firm. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we're talking about the so-called cooperative economy. Some see cooperativism as an alternative to traditional winner-take-all capitalism. Gar Alperovitz is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. He's the author of Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. He also recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times titled Worker Owners of America Unite. Carla Dickstein is Senior Vice President for Research and Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc. They join me to discuss the rise of the cooperative economy. This is Maine Calling. And in our studio, Carla Dickstein, Senior Vice President for Research and Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc., and Gar Alperovitz from Washington, D.C., joining us today as a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland. And welcome to you both. Gar, let's start with you. Could help us understand what the cooperative economy is, or the definition of cooperativism.
Well, I think it goes beyond what most people think about in terms of the local co-op. I wrote this book, America Beyond Capitalism, because there is a developing trend of a different kind of economic institution and some wonderful work that's been done by Coastal Enterprises up there in connection with co-ops. But the idea is very straightforward. 1% of American society owns just under half of the investment capital, the businesses, the factories, the farms, the stores. 1%. 5% owns something like 70%. So that's one way to organize an economy, which is very undemocratic. The alternative is, in one form or another, to have a democratic ownership. The co-op being a one-person, one-vote way of doing that, either a productive co-op or a consumer co-op. But there are other forms as well. Worker-owned companies of a different kind have less participation, although there's an increasing trend there. There are something like 13 million Americans involved in worker-owned companies that have a direction that is moving towards more democracy. But it democratizes ownership, sometimes with participation, sometimes without, and hopefully increasingly. So that's a broad range of things that I would include in the vision of an America beyond capitalism that has really changes who owns the wealth of the nation from the kind of almost medieval pattern. I say that not rhetorically. That's concentrations of ownership are the way it was in ancient society, very, very concentrated, and the alternative is a democratizing of wealth.
So would your vision be the entire country's economic fabric made up of these employee-owned companies, or do you see these employee-owned companies working sort of side by side in our traditional capitalism?
Well, I think that's an open question. What's interesting is that the pain levels around the economy and in the society that everyone's feeling, they're forcing people to experiment with new models. It isn't simply that I'm advocating a cooperative and worker-owned and in some municipal utilities and different forms of ownership. I think those are more democratic than concentrated corporate ownership. But what's happening, I think, and America Beyond Capitalism is all about this trend, I think there are people being forced to innovate at the local level, trying to find a new way because lots of things are failing. And we'll see how far that trend goes. It goes into states. As you know, there's a state bank in North Dakota, which is a more democratic form, and 14 or 15 states have introduced legislation to do that rather than the Wall Street model. There are a number of states that are now, something like 20 states have introduced single-payer health care, which is essentially a public insurance company, rather than the big insurance companies. You might even say, what happens with the next financial crisis? At some point, I think some of these Wall Street banks are getting us into so much trouble that some of them might even be made into public utilities. We did nationalize Chrysler and General Motors, after all. But what I'm really trying to write about, and what I think is so important, is at the local level that there is a developmental process that is giving people real experience with different forms of ownership. And folks in Maine have done, as I say, Coastal Enterprises is a leader in helping make this happen.
Carla Dickstein, you indeed are at the center of this as Senior Vice President for Research and Policy at Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc. Where are we in Maine in the terms of the cooperative economy?
Well, I don't have the figures of the growth, but what I'm hearing, ad hoc is certainly there's more interest in this economy and the downturn particularly. Last year, I know I talked with a union representative that said that her union was very interested in looking at cooperatives. In fact, there's a co-op conference happening tomorrow on ag co-ops and fishing co-ops. And I think people are looking for solutions. And I think that happens particularly in downtimes. You know, you're looking to control your economics in your life. And that certainly has happened historically.
To join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566 or talk at mpbn.net is our email. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet at Maine Calling. Some of the co-ops, Carla, that you're talking about seem to do primarily with ways of selling, natural commodities, so fish and farm products. Does this system work for, selling whirligigs or widgets?
Yeah, it can. It depends who's involved with it. And like any business, you need an entrepreneur. Co-ops, even though they're democratically controlled, also need the same talent a small business needs. And so the incentive structure is a little bit different in a co-op, even if they don't necessarily have to have equal pay for everybody. But you don't usually get the same returns for the entrepreneur that you would get in a small business. So I over the years, after studying this and seeing ventures in Maine, it seems to me there's also an ideological component to it as well as the practical to get that off. But that said, we also have employee stock ownership plans, which are employee-owned. They're not necessarily employee-controlled. But that seems to be the one that's easier to start in Maine, and partially because it's incentivized with tax federal tax incentives.
That's known as the ESOP.
That's right. Right. And, Chimbra, one of our biggest companies in Maine, it's majority-owned. It's the largest majority-owned ESOP in Maine and top 100 in the country.
So the idea there is if employees have a stake in terms of stocks or in the company, they're sort of motivated to be part of making sure that the company –
Yes, except the research also shows that it's the combination of participation – in the company, hands-on participation as well as ownership that gives you the biggest bang for the buck.
Gar Alprovitz, if this is such a great system and a good idea, and you mentioned some examples of how it has been incorporated in the U.S., what are some of the obstacles?
Well, I think one of the obstacles is simply knowledge. What we've been doing is researching what's happening on the ground, and I cover a fair amount of it in the book. But people simply don't know what you can do. They don't know that there are extraordinary things going on around the country. They don't really have the press doesn't cover this sector. There's very little in. You have to search it out. As I say, one of the reasons I wrote America Beyond Capitalism is simply to report on this. Now, if you go online, there are tremendous resources. And in fact, there's really interesting, Carla was talking about the research, when you put together ownership, even in employee stock ownership plans with adequate training, you get better productivity, you get better retirement, you get better profits compared with comparable firms. Also, there are really interesting experiments. You asked about what sectors. Around the world, there is a very famous, very large complex of co-ops called Mondragon in the Basque country of Spain that many people have begun to take interest in this country. But this involves a whole mix of co-ops, everything from building and construction to manufacturing to high-tech research and medical equipment. Not your corner co-op. You can do this at scale. We think this is really important because a lot of people have discovered this, and the Steelworkers Union is now made a pact U.S. Steelworkers Union with Mondragon to begin developing more of the U.S. economy that way, which again, and Carla mentioned the unions, again, this interest, which was not present until very recently, that unions are beginning to think about it too, which gives you another way forward. The obstacle, first obstacle is knowledge, and I think the second obstacle, we may run into political problems, but I'm not sure. Forbes magazine, one of the most conservative business magazines, just ran an online review of America Beyond Capitalism and an article I wrote, and very favorable to this direction in development. I was quite surprised at it. There is a sense, I think, even amongst traditional business people, that the large giant corporation and the Wall Street banks are one thing, but this kind of development is another. And I think that, you know, there's maybe real possibilities. I did want to pick up on one thing also that was mentioned. Carlos mentioned in hard times, people are looking for this sort of thing. I think that's absolutely right. But one of the things that I think is important to at least consider, and I write more about it in the book, is that we may actually be entering an era of continued hard times. I don't think the pendulum is going to swing, and we could go into a long economic analysis of that, but I think this painful period with minor ripples up and down is more likely to be the next decade or two of our experience. And that's the kind of environment where people really begin to think about where are we really going, and also are forced to experiment, even pointing towards either a much larger democratic sector would be the phrase I'd use, or maybe something that looks beyond capitalism in its traditional form, beyond socialism too. It's very American in this decentralized sense of where we're going. The long historical view, I take partly thinking about it, is where does this all point to over the next 2-3 decades?
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Email to talk@mpbn.net. Facebook, leave a comment on our Facebook page or send us a tweet at Maine Calling. My guests are Carla Dickstein, Senior Vice President for Research and Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc., and Gar Alpervitz, joining us from Washington, is a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He's the author of America Beyond Capitalism. Gar, you mentioned the maybe some political barriers. Some of this, I'm guessing, to some smacks of socialism a bit. When you're, although we're a country that loves the idea of democracy, we traditionally are reluctant to apply that when it comes to business for some reason. And I'm wondering, is some of the criticism or some of the barriers that you see coming from people who are sort of nervous about maybe inadvertently supporting socialism in some form?
Well, I think that certainly that ideological barrier to large-scale changes is rampant in at least parts of the American political spectrum. But when you look at the kind of things we're talking about that are emerging at the local and state level, that's a little different story. People who can actually talk about things that make sense locally, that are practical, that produce jobs, and you find a very different, it's not the same ideological debate that we see every day here in Washington. It's much more about, does this work? Does it make sense? Is it practical? And one of the exciting things is there is so much available on the ground, as I say, not covered by the press, and I try to report on it in America Beyond Capitalism, but there are also many web pages that survey this. One important one is community-wealth.org. Be sure to put the dash in. It just surveys what's going on, that people can see well past ideologies. And the other thing that's quite interesting, which is two things, and then you can stop me because I'll go on. I'm very interested in this. One of them is there is a really interesting set of surveys by Rasmussen, the surveying company, fairly conservative, by the way. And it found in 2009 that people under 30, and these are the people who are going to make the new society, they're the ones the younger generation is going to make the next society, are indifferent. They don't see much difference between, quote, capitalism and, quote, socialism. And they're certainly not brought up the way, certainly I was brought up, that the Red Scare and anything, and Joe Stalin, that's just not present. And they redid the survey 2 weeks ago. And surprisingly, this same group, people under 30 who are going to be the people creating the society, moved about 4 or 5 points slightly in the direction of socialism. I don't think they are talking about socialism. What I think they're talking about is being open to something very new, whatever, you know, socialism kind of just rhetoric. But the sense that they're not afraid of this kind of a direction and that the younger people are going to carry the ball, plus on-the-ground practical experience with, in my experience, with so-called conservatives and so-called liberals and so-called radicals, when you actually talk practically, what should we do here? Co-ops make sense. Worker-owned companies make sense. Ronald Reagan was one of the leading figures behind the ESOP movement. He was a very strong supporter of ESOPs. One of the most conservative members of Congress is a man named Dana Rohrabacher from California, and he thinks the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, that form of worker ownership, ought to have one person, one vote control, much more democratic than anybody else's, but it coming from the, I guess, sort of the Ron Paul part of the world. There's a whole different way of thinking about things that I think may take us over time. And I think, as I said, as a historian, the way to think about this is the prehistory of the New Deal. The decades that led up to the New Deal were all kind of experimented with in what Justice Brandeis called the laboratories of the local experience. And then as that built up over time, it became possible to do larger things nationally. Same with the women's vote in the 19th century, state by state by state, decade after decade, and then something happened at the national level finally. So that's the possibility that I think is beginning to create what I call an America beyond capitalism, possibly that direction as the pain levels deepen and as other things aren't working.
Okay, we're going to we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call. We have phones, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Britain's Queen Elizabeth celebrates 60 years on the throne next month. A new biography looks at the public and private life of a modern monarch.
You can join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by BizCompass, a Maine company dedicated to maximizing privacy and versatility of business information systems using its private cloud, online at bizcompass.net, and by Ride Aroostook, a cycling tour of Aroostook County in August benefiting Camp Adventure for children with type 1 diabetes. Register at ridearoostook.org.
And welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about our economy and possible alternatives to traditional capitalism. Our guests are Carla Dickstein, Senior Vice President for Research and Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc., and Gar Alperovitz, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He's the author of America Beyond Capitalism. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. We do have an email from Deborah Hawkins of Cooperative Maine, who points out that there's a conference on producer co-ops for Maine fishing and farming communities, which is Thursday in Unity, for those who are interested. We thank Deborah for letting us know about that. Let's go now to Harpswell and Robert. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Yes, what's your question?
I wanted to point out this Alperovitz discussion is very interesting, and that there are examples far beyond Mondragon, including French Canada and Finland, that are all very similar in a structural way. They have supportive local government, and they have some kind of an internal bank. And when you put those two together with local ideas for products and forms of organization, you sometimes can generate growth and development with high social returns based on local resources without external money.
Yeah, Robert, I want to bring Carla in here, too. We were talking before we came on air about some of the fundamental differences between Europe and the U.S. with respect to, you know, some of the factors that I guess allow for co-ops to be more accepted in Europe, maybe.
Yeah, I did do quite a bit of research, particularly on Mondragon and particularly the support structures that you're talking about. And you can't really get the scale of co-ops that Mondragon or the Italian or French co-ops, I'm not familiar with Finland, have without these support structures, a financing mechanism, a technical assistance ability, active policy development. And one of the other things they do is they standardize often the co-op structure. For example, one of the biggest things in Mondragon was forcing internal financing or savings so that there's a pool of money to draw on. They also had very favorable national legislation that permitted them to set up a credit union that could draw local money when they first started. But the other thing was there. What I saw was a definite difference in culture, a more cooperative culture. Italy was similar, and it's harder in the U.S., I think, to have that kind of background. Certainly when CEI first started in the 70s, co-ops were a big part of the agenda. And we found it quite difficult to get them going, except in fishing co-ops, where there was more similar interests and they came together with producer co-ops.
Robert, what's your take on that and Americans', I guess, cultural willingness to American culture's rather willingness to accept embrace this kind of idea?
Well, exactly that the Cold War prevented gathering information about what works with capitalist institutions, but different details. And so you have, like, Raiffeisen Bank, one of the biggest banks in Europe, and I've repressed the name of the Dutch bank, are cooperative banks, and yet nobody knows that. They just see them float through financial reports, and they think, it's another bank, but it's actually a cooperative bank. The link between financing and local government is crucial, and as Carla just mentioned, the Mondragon system has something maybe like Coastal Enterprises, where there's an investment banking or venture capital office which vets proposals and tests them to see if they're plausible. And then if they're financed by the cooperative bank, they're put under very tight control and supervision for their first few years until they really get going. So it's not things just flying up and working. It's really careful thinking about what can be successful. With respect to the U.S. influence or being closed to U.S. influences, cooperative or credit unions in the United States on the East Coast were founded with the support of Filene, who saw them at work in India and then had an assistant that discovered Credit Desjardins had already started in Quebec, and the Massachusetts legislature adopted in translation much of the Quebec credit union. So there has been, in the United States, a credit union development, which is part of a cooperative tradition, and it's there, but it isn't noticed that much. I think there's a great possibility if people know their choices.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
To move in this direction. Thank
All right.
you.
Thanks
wonderful
for,
program.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is a wonderful conversation and really informed. The caller obviously knows his research, and Carla's done research. Let me just add to this, because we've been watching the trend possibilities in this area and some very interesting experiments. The financing mechanism of some sort of bank or credit union or credit pool is really critical. And there's a very interesting model that's being developed and is ongoing and is expanding in Cleveland, Ohio, which really follows exactly the principles we're talking about here. And they're large-scale worker-owned companies in a very poor part of Cleveland, a black community of $18,000 a year family income, but with the backing of the big hospitals and universities in that area buy something like $3 billion in goods and services, leaving aside salaries and construction. And there's an attempt to say, well, why don't we buy some here and use that as a partial market for some of these co-ops? So there are a series of co-ops that are linked together with a financing pool and a nonprofit corporation aiming at building up the community, not just the workers. The worker, they're worker-owned, but they're part of a complex like Mondragon. And in this case, it's very hard to sell it off, but trying to build a community. And they pay back some of their profits to a central pool, a revolving fund, again, like this Mondragon. But the idea is to build out and also to use the purchasing power of these big these institutions like hospitals and universities that have so much public taxpayer money in them. Why not? And what's interesting about it is the model is expanding in many parts of the country now. There are a number of cities that are trying to pick up on this model and say, well, we could do that here and rebuild the locally using this model, changing who owns wealth, democratizing it. So I think that the knowledge has been a bigger barrier perhaps even than culture, although culture was very important both in the Italian and particularly the Mondragon case. We're experiencing this. Our democracy collaborative has been looking at this and been working in it. And all of a sudden, light bulbs are going on. And again, it returns you to this real question of hard times. In a place like Cleveland, but in many other cities, we're talking about Pittsburgh and Atlanta and the suburbs of Washington and Oakland, California, nothing's working, and the pain levels are deepening. And it's in that environment that people are saying, something's got to be done, and they roll up their sleeves and begin saying, what could we do if we start looking around and see what other folks are doing? And as I say, America Beyond Capitalism is simply, in part, a report on this. But there is plenty of experience, and I think the cultural barrier is less difficult. I agree with the caller. And I think because of the hard times, it's going to become less and less difficult. Knowledge is the big one, and I think hopefully now we'll get past the place where it was so hard to start co-ops. That's absolutely right, but yeah. I think it's slowly changing.
Okay. 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or send us a tweet at Maine Calling. We'll go to Ed in Portland. Hi, Ed. Ed, are you still with us?
I sure am.
Yes. Hi. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Keith.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Great show. As always, really enjoy Maine Calling and looking forward to reading Gar's book. And Carla does great work at CEI. Great to see them working on cooperatives. Just a quick correction. The Producer Cooperative Conference is on Thursday, January 19th at the Mofka Fairgrounds. And that's linked for more information. If I can just put in a plug, cooperativemaine.org. It's linked off of there for more information and to register. But I just wanted to make a point that it really the history of cooperatives is pretty long, and there's sort of an ideological component, as there is to everything. Carla mentioned the ideological component, actually, it nicely offers a very pragmatic, practical bridge model from our current system that ties in nicely with microenterprise and locally based human scale economics. It's a way to move beyond on very practical terms, whether it's food or housing or producer cooperatives. From the existing entrepreneurial economy and put resources into developing microenterprise and locally based economics without the interference of ideology.
Yeah, Ed, thanks for calling. Carla, though you've had some, there's not a whole lot of money coming through from the federal government, for example, for this sort of enterprise.
Not specifically that I know about. You get the financing from other sources. I mean, we can finance co-ops. We will if we see a good deal, and we have done fishing co-ops and others. We can finance ESOPs, which we've done. The issue is more the proactive outreach that Gar is talking about to make people aware of the models. And that we've tried to get funding for that and have not been able to. And if anybody knows where we can get it, we will go after it.
Gar, isn't fundamentally, though, no investor is going to
give money to a co-op that it doesn't think is going to have a return. So in some senses, while this is a departure from what we consider to be traditional capitalism, some of those rules apply if we're talking about the basics of investment, right?
Well, there are two different ways to think about this, and probably more than that. But if you think about the ESOP world we talked about, that's worker ownership through this employee stock ownership plan, in which there are something like 13 or 14 million Americans involved, 5 or 6 million more than are involved in unions in the private sector. It's a big deal. There you have – it is financed in a way in the traditional way, and employees can buy into it slowly and steadily. But there are very large tax benefits. And again, this is very interesting because it's conservative and liberal people got together – a conservative banker named Kelso and the Senator Long, the son of Huey Long, was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And the way it works is this. If you're a private, and most worker-owned companies so far have been brought about this way, if you've built a business and you're retiring and your choices and your son and daughter don't want to take it over, commonly, and by the way, lots of people are retiring. The baby boom is retiring, so this is a big deal. You can sell it to a big company. Very often they will consolidate the operation and move jobs away. Or there are very large tax benefits to sell it to your workers, and then it can be financed directly because it is inherently a profitable company. That's what we're talking about, transferring a profitable company, and then you can finance it. The other thing that we're seeing is that there are people who are willing to invest in one way or another in what's sometimes called slow capital or low return capital. It must be some return, but they're willing to build up the economy partly out of goodwill. Or there's internal financing of the way Mondragon does it and the way this Cleveland group is doing it, which begins building profits and helps set up a revolving fund. Finally, there's still other things, and this gets you to the ideological picture, which is really interesting. The state treasurer of the state of Indiana, very conservative treasurer, is using state funds to set up a fund and lower the interest rates for worker-owned companies. So I'm seeing a mix of ways to get at the financing problem, some of which are traditional and some of which are, you know, developing just in this direction. The old co-op bank, which was established several years ago, was a preliminary model. It's done very well, but it isn't taken on an aggressive position, an aggressive stance. A new direction in that might very well be possible. Some of the state banks that are being contemplated could very well make this a priority. There are lots of things that can be done in this direction.
All right, go ahead.
These are profitable. These are businesses that are viable by definition, or you wouldn't do them.
Sure,
we're not talking about.
Yeah, it may. I think I got your point. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
I'm Ray Suarez, coming up on America Abroad. From Iraq and Iran to Afghanistan and Pakistan, we'll look back at past American influence and intervention in the Middle East and ask, what will the future of American policy in the region look like? America and the Middle East, what lies ahead on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Join us for America Abroad this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Next time on The World, U.S. lawmakers hope to block online sales of pirated movies, music, and books. Spain wants to do the same thing, and it's getting the same pushback from internet activists. They say anti-piracy laws will hurt more than just the pirates.
They will shut you down, because that's the only thing that they do, they shut you down.
Debate over anti-piracy laws in Spain, next time on The World.
And you can tune in for The World this afternoon at 3.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Today on the program, Capitalism Under Attack? Could it be? Share your thoughts. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or send us a tweet at Maine Calling. It needn't be capitalism under attack, but we're really talking about alternatives to capitalism at a time when people are questioning some of the consequences of capitalism, the extreme consequences of capitalism. Let's go now to California. Yes, you heard me. California. And Frederick joins us. Frederick, hi. Are you listening to our stream?
I am. Yeah, wow. You come in loud and clear.
Wow, great. And what's the weather? I have to ask, what's the weather in California today?
Well, you know, in Northern California, we have frost in the morning. So the predominant crop out here, which is grapes, loves the frost, helps the sugar run. Tonight, it's upper 20s, but today will rise to about 50 or so.
Yeah. My grapes are not doing very well right now.
No, they're not.
No.
I'm kind of disappointed. I see no snow here, but I will manage.
Sure.
Thanks so much for this conversation today. And I wanted to ask the hosts about, you know, over the last 30 movements, there was a strong movement of businesses for social responsibility. Those had a positive and social public policy input. I'm thinking of business like nationally, Patagonia, and our family uses a phone service and credit cards through Credo, which offers a positive social impact. And we've seen a lot of this in New England. Businesses like L.L. Bean for many years, Oakhurst Dairy, Tom's of Maine, Burt's Bees, Stonyfield. Could you folks address the effects of the movement of these businesses of social responsibility?
Gar?
I'm happy to, and I'm sure Carla knows a good deal about this as well. That there is a trend, and this is part of just of what you're talking about. People that are interested either in investing for social in a socially responsible way, investing in companies that do not pollute, that do not create greenhouse gases, and so forth. Non-defense is often a category, and then there are other places like Stonyfield and Stony Brook also developing, which begin with a vision that is different from, it's a more ecological and consumer-oriented vision and often community-oriented vision. I think that's part and parcel of the developing quietly, very quietly developing new economy that we're talking about. And I think that's the main point, that there are people who have a sense we've got to go in a different direction. And either for, in many cases here, the environmental and consumer issues stand out. But they're beginning to build a culture and a knowledge base. And remember, I think of it, and I think the right way to think of it is historically, laying down ideas and new experiments and trying things in different communities, learning about this. That takes time. But as the pain goes on, and as people get more conscious, I think particularly of the climate change issue, we're going to see more people doing just what the caller was talking about. And also, I want to say, and moving it to the city and state level, where there are state banks can be set up, or in San Francisco, where you are, one of the councilmen has proposed using, and this could be done in Maine, by the way, using the city or state deposits. There's a lot of cash flow in Portland. In San Francisco, I think it was something like $2 billion. Why use the city money and put it in the Bank of America? Why not set up a credit union or a city or a public bank like the State Bank of North Dakota and use it to develop both the city but also these new enterprises? That sort of thing is being considered in many parts of the country, not often reported on. And again, one of the reasons I wrote this book, America Beyond Capitalism, there is so much of this direction, and the moral aspects are critical, that just as the caller said, a vision of a different way and different guiding principles for businesses coming out, even of parts of the business community, and the ones he mentioned, I think, are right on.
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's go to Waldoboro and Ken. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program. Ken, are you still with us? Okay, we have lost Ken. Let's instead go to Orono and Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your question?
I want to have a little more deeper analysis of how we make the transition out of a worldwide financial system that's essentially owned and run by a very small cartel of people. Even the idea of state banks doesn't necessarily have the deeper understanding and intelligence that's needed to actually fund some of these idealistic ideas of how we can move forward. Because you could start a state bank and it would not necessarily fund co-ops or socially or environmentally responsible businesses. And so the Federal Reserve pretty much owns everything. It owns Standard & Poor's, it owns Bank of America, it owns J.P. Morgan. Our Federal Reserve system is paired with France. the stockbrokers and credit default swap brokers and all of the rest of them have built a financial system that has gone beyond usury. And so if we want to try and look at a way to transition our culture through this financial system, we have to look beyond even what's being spoken about today. Oftentimes, people who are in charge of any kind of government or nonprofit entity that funds alternative movements to try and get economic security on a local, statewide, or national basis are like David and Goliath.
Yeah. Jane, let's bring our guests in here. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to give them a chance to respond. Thanks for calling. I guess the question there was, Gar, how do we do this? And I think you mentioned earlier that it's sort of, you know, happening, you know, town by town, state by state.
Well, look, I think what the caller's pointing to something that's very real. It may be that it is not possible ever to change what's happening. That's a possibility. Logically. On the other hand, I'm a historian, and if you look around, the obstacles, massive political obstacles to change, are quite common in world history, and yet transitions and transformations occur because people slowly and agonizingly, steadily build up a different vision and begin to challenge some of these practices. I think the beginning point is locally and in the states, where you can begin to push back in different areas and begin to develop. My own feeling is that the pain levels and the failures that we're looking at now are making some people very vulnerable. Some of the people who are causing, these big banks in that she's mentioning caused trillions of dollars of pain and economic pain and bailouts. So they're vulnerable politically over time. I don't think you're going to do this in tomorrow's election. And if you think it's a short-term thing, probably you shouldn't do it. But if you see it as how movements historically build up in other countries, our own country, it took on the biggest empire in the world, the strongest army and navy, and defeated it. I think of the long, long, difficult fight is what we're talking about. But I think there's a lot of experience that people need to look at that is very positive. There's an America that's beyond capitalism. The title of the book is reporting on what's out there that is slowly building up. So this is not for people who are – it's useful to do these things no matter what.
Yeah.
But a larger vision of the kind that might challenge the things she's talking about, that's thinking about it a different way.
Carla, here we are in Maine.
Yeah. We've got money to invest. The issue for us is good investments. And a part of that problem is the 1% versus 99%. I think it's a huge policy issue to get the income distribution in line, that you create more demand and more of a better economic environment. I know I'm not addressing your question of power and the Federal Reserve and what roles those institutions play, but I think we're going in the right direction with raising the issue of economic disparity in this country. And if we had better demand and better markets, we would put more money in all kinds of businesses.
Carla and Gar, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Carla Dickstein. We're out of time. We're out of time. Real quick, Gar.
Just a shout out to CIA and Ron Phillips for starting up one of the best organizations in the country.
Okay.
Devoted to this.
Thank you, Gar.
Carla Dickstein, Senior Vice President for Research and Policy Development at Coastal Enterprises, Inc. Gar Alperovitz, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, founder of the Democracy Collaborative, author of America Beyond Capitalism. Program produced by Jonathan Smith. Lindsay Maynard ran our board. Our volunteer, Cindy Han, answered your calls. We also had help from John Keimel and the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. This is the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.